Radio.com.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to, I guess we should call it an Aryan Narrations Extra. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and I thought, since we've just worked our way through Geoffrey of Monmouth's The History of the Kings of Britain, it might be worth discussing some of the points raised in it. There've been quite a few comments that have been left and questions about it, asking whether it was mythological, whether it was all made up, that sort of thing. I think parts of it are truthful, and obviously there are also some other semi-legendary parts to it. And there are also confirmations of the kings in it that are found elsewhere. And if we go back to the beginning and we see that it starts off with Brutus of Troy. Brutus is also mentioned in the Iliad. I believe he's called Pirutus there rather than Brutus. And his friend Corineus, he's mentioned in the Iliad as well. And they have similar adventures. And we've also got places that are named after these people. In Totnes, we have the Brutus Stone, which is the stone where Brutus first stepped off the boat onto the shores of Britain. And of course, we also have Gogmagog's Leap in Plymouth Hoe, which is where Corineus supposedly threw the giant off the cliff there. And also in London, we have a stone in London, which is called the London Stone, which is apparently very low down. It's below the streets now. There's a grate, and you can look down this grate down into the earth, and there's a stone at the bottom there, and apparently that's a stone that was laid by Brutus. We also hear about him in Gildas, who wrote On the Ruin of Britain. And Gildas was very anti the British and very pro-Roman. And he says that Brutus was a Roman consul. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he was Roman, because don't forget, the Romans were descended from Aeneas and Silvius, the same as Brutus was. So the Romans were brothers to the Britons. So to say that Brutus was a Roman consul is the equivalent of saying that he was a Roman prince. And of course, he was a Roman prince. So the Romans and the Britons were brother nations, as it were. They were both descended from the Trojans. And when the Romans did away with their royal family, Tarquin, I believe his name was, and I think he raped someone, and so they did away with their royal family. So what they did then was the nobles would marry into the British royal family, and then they would stand a better chance of getting to the Senate or becoming emperor, as we see with our British King Constantine, that eventually became emperor. And there's a lot of confusion about Constantine the Great, because there was also Constantine the Tyrant. And we hear in the history of the kings of Britain, we hear about this tyrant, this other Constantine that is born after Constantine the Great. So some people have confused the two and tried to say that Constantine was a bad guy, and it's basically because there were two people called Constantine. In fact, I think there were three. And one of my favourite parts from it is the legend of Bladud, the king that was the first to develop a flying machine and flew up in the air and crash-landed on the Temple of Apollo 600 or 1,000 years before Christ. Apparently, could probably actually find out the time of that. I've got the time frame here in front of me. Where was Bladud? Yeah, about 600 years before Christ, I think. We've got records of London that go back that far to Cartroy, apparently it was called, which stands for New Troy. And of course, when Julius Caesar came to Britain, he wrote of the Trinovantians that were living in London. And Trinovanti is Troy Nova. So it's the people from New Troy. So this is all confirmation that the British people originally came from the Trojans. Now, there are other legends that say that there were other people here first that were kinsmen of Brutus. And Brutus was really just the first royalty that was here that united the island. And of course, they always like to have legends of doing away with giants. And these giants that they did away with, they may have been nature deities or nature spirits at the time. You just don't know. There's also a book called The Brute, which collects together all the early Latin and Greek and Welsh manuscripts and puts them all together. And The Brute, or the Chronicle of England, it was second only to the Bible in the most read book for centuries, I believe. And it was the history book that school children learned right the way up until the 20th century. And then what they did then, they said, oh, this was all made up. Troy didn't exist. And then they found the remains of Troy did exist, and they found them in Asia Minor. But the establishment still tries to mock and ridicule this history of ours. To take us back to Car Troyer, London, New Troy, Geoffrey of Monmouth tells us about how Cassivellaunus, I believe it was, or Cymbeline, one of these kings planted these metal stakes into the Thames to stop Caesar from being able to land. Claudius Caesar, I believe, it was the second Caesar that tried to invade. And the remains of those stakes could still be seen up until fairly recently. You could see these stakes dug into the river. And we did actually, we defeated Julius Caesar on his first visit. We sent him packing. And the second time, Claudius Caesar didn't get any further than London. It wasn't until the third time that they actually had a treaty and a truce with the Romans. But we still weren't happy with it. As you can tell from the history of the kings of Britain, the Britons are constantly trying to throw off the yoke of the Romans. And then after Maximentius goes on his rampage through Europe and conquers Gaul, he encourages all the best people, all the alpha males and all the beautiful women and all the nobles, all of them to move out to Gaul and repopulate the area that he had devastated. So all the decent people from Britain moved away, leaving the country just full of the lower castes who were unaware of how to fight. So as soon as that was learned, the Picts and the Scots and Saxons, they all came in invading, and the Britons went cap in hand to Rome asking for the help from Rome. And at first, the Romans help out. They come to the country, they build a wall, they teach the peasants how to make their own weapons, but the Britons are still unable to defend themselves. So they ask Rome again, the groans of the Britons, to Caesar, please come and help us out. And this time Caesar says, no, not helping you this time. You'll have to defend yourselves. And then thankfully we end up with King Arthur, who did defend the island. And again, the establishment today will try and say that King Arthur is mythical. And yet at the time, in the Welsh records, when King Arthur was fighting against the Saxons and making his way across Europe to Rome, fighting against Lucius, there's a gap in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle because the Saxons weren't here. They weren't ruling at the time. So that fits in with it. Some people say that King Arthur had a different name, and that there were two King Arthurs, and there was one King Arthur that battled against Rome, and there was another King Arthur that battled against the Saxons. And Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett have done a lot of research in this area on these two King Arthurs, and they've found all these places that are talked about in this. And this brings us to another one of these mythical or semi-mythical events that it talks about. When it talks about the Giant's Ring, it's always been supposed that was talking about Stonehenge, and this idea that Merlin went to Ireland and used his magic to bring the stones back from Ireland to Britain was all a legend, and there was no traces of any of these legendary kings buried in this Giant's Ring. But Baron Blackett and Alan Wilson claim that this ring wasn't in Salisbury. It was somewhere else, and they've found the area where it is, and it's full of tumuli. It's full of these graves of these kings. It's got a battlefield nearby, which Stonehenge doesn't. It fits all the criteria for actually being the correct place. So again, we've got confirmation of the events happening, but not in the way that we thought that they did. We've also got the Christianization of Britain, which, according to Geoffrey of Monmouth, took place around about 150 AD, with which king was it? King Lucius, who died in 156 AD. Now, the story is that King Lucius wrote to Pope Eleutherius in Rome asking to become a Christian. And that's one of the records that's been passed down to us. The Roman Catholic Church liked to tell us that one. But there's another record that says that Lucius wrote to Rome asking for Rome to give Britain Christian laws, because Lucius had already become Christian. He'd been preached to by the apostles Joseph of Arimathea and various other apostles that came with him after the death and resurrection of Christ. And he asked Pope Eleutherius for the Roman laws. And Eleutherius said, you don't need the Roman laws. All you need is the law of the Bible. If you have the Roman laws, things will become corrupt and you'll become as corrupt as Rome. So you've got two different tales there. The Roman Catholic Church would like to say that Lucius was converted by them and asked Pope Eleutherius to be baptized, whereas the Welsh records say that Lucius was converted by the descendants of Joseph of Arimathea and his apostles, and just asked Pope Eleutherius about these laws. So you've got two different stories there. It doesn't actually tell you about Caractacus in Geoffrey of Monmouth's book, but we hear about Caractacus or Caradoc in the Roman histories. And Caradoc may have been Cymbeline that Geoffrey of Monmouth talks about. You have to be aware that where these things happened so far back in the past, a lot of them were just recounted orally. And the bards would sing songs about them, and they'd add little bits to it. And you know, if there was a bit in the story that where the king wasn't acting too honourably, they would exaggerate it slightly. And over the years, you end up with more exaggerations, but there was always a kernel of truth to it. And they were very, very serious about keeping their pedigree. If you were a druid, you had to prove that you had been a free man from a noble family for 10 generations back before you could go and study to be a druid. And these kings, they kept their records, they kept their family trees, because it was really important to them, their ethnicity and the purity of their blood, so that they weren't mixed in with these other castes. We did have a caste system. And I think you can see from Geoffrey of Monmouth's book that the British people were very noble. They may have gone out and devastated these other countries and genocided people over in Europe, but it was always over treaty breaking or truce breaking or oath breaking. A man's word is such a valuable thing, and if a man breaks his word, then he really has no value whatsoever. And so there was so much importance that was placed on the value of the word, which is why they went and attacked Rome that second time. And it's also interesting to know that the British people, Belinus and Brennius, they first sacked Rome back in 390 BC. We had British kings ruling in Rome. And of course, then we had Constantine, the emperor, who went to Rome. And third time, we have Arthur, who defeats Lucius. But then he has to come back because his people have behaved treasonably. Mordred has taken Arthur's wife to bed and put the crown of the kingdom on his head and tried to take over. And this is another thing that is so sad. You hear about all this backstabbing and civil war between the British people. And that's what eventually led to the Saxons being able to defeat the Britons. It was because the Britons kept fighting among themselves. And this reminds me a lot of, it also reminds me a lot of the Old Testament. We hear a lot of criticism of the Old Testament. White people would never behave like that. But if you have listened to these narrations from Geoffrey of Monmouth, it's full of people behaving like they do in the Old Testament. The king, King Vortigern, is searching for Merlin so that he can make a human sacrifice out of him. So that he can put his blood on the foundations of the castle, so that the castle won't get thrown down every night. And the fact that this was suggested, it was suggested that they find this young boy and human sacrifice him, shows that it wasn't unheard of. It wasn't an unheard of thing. It's a bit shocking. I mean, they've never actually found any evidence of human sacrifice in Britain. Was always alleged against the Druids that by Caesar, but there's never been found any evidence of that. And of course, also in the Greek myths, we hear of human sacrifice. So to say that the Old Testament white people would never behave like that, I think they do behave like that, especially in this book here, The History of the Kings of Britain. There is some very bad behaviour in it, and some mistreatment of the people. There's sodomite kings that go against nature. The Saxons poisoning people, sneaking in and poisoning people, setting up a love day. I mean, that was atrocious behaviour, that, when the Saxons and the Britons arranged to have a peace conference, and all the nobles from the Britons go there unarmed, and the Saxons are supposed to be unarmed, but they whip out their boot knives and slaughter all the British nobility. And I believe that was on the words of something like, "Now let us talk of peace and love." And this is another interesting thing. It was called a love day. And of course, love has a different connotation today. It's linked with lust. But back then, it meant caring about the well-being of somebody else. So a love day was a peace day. And the Saxons, by the end of the book, they actually come across in a better light than the British do. And Geoffrey of Monmouth says that the Saxons, after they had become Christian, they started behaving themselves. And they united and they stopped fighting among one another, whereas the Britons continued to fight. And Alfred the Great, by the time we get to Alfred the Great, his achievements were just incredible. Getting everybody reading, translating the Bible into English, hanging 100 judges for being crooked, writing up the laws. And the laws that Alfred the Great wrote up, some of them go back to the Molmutine laws. Molmutius, 600 BC, the ancient British law code. Part of that law code was that if you could get to a temple, then your enemies had to let you go. You had to be given sanctuary if you could get into a temple. And this was before churches. This was if you could get to the stone circle, then you were safe. And that got carried on into the churches. And if you could make it to a church, you should be safe. But of course, by the time we get to the end of the book, you've got a British king that slaughters two Saxon princes when they're at the altar in the church. So, of course, this is why Geoffrey of Monmouth, at the end, he's saying, well, this is God's punishment of the British. They lost their island because of the way they behaved. And that's not to say that the Saxons had a much better time of it, because, as we all know, the Vikings came and gave the Saxons a good run for their money. Burning down everything that the Saxons had built, the universities, and basically they got paid back for everything that they did to the Welsh. It just seems to me that that's the way things go. If nations behave badly, nations get punished for it. A love of money being the main thing. Now, if you look at the way our nations are today, they're all based around usury, and we're being punished for that. We've been invaded by foreigners. We've got foreigners above us telling us what to do, foreigners living in our houses, foreigners breeding with our daughters. It's all punishment for us turning our back on God, basically. We've got the natural law. We've got the law that our ancestors told us was correct. And this is another thing about Christianity. There were so many martyrs, people that would rather die than say that they made it all up. They would rather die. And they willingly went to death. They willingly went to these hideous deaths because they knew that what they had seen was true. Thousands of people saw the risen Christ. Thousands of people. And some of them were put to death for saying what they saw. Now that tells me that is truthful. That is what they saw. If they're willing to die because they're so certain that when they die, they're going to go to heaven because they've seen the risen Christ, and you've got thousands of witnesses, and our ancestors believed those witnesses, believed that they were correct and what they had told them was the truth, then if I am to honour my ancestors, then I have to believe the same. We have to believe the same. It's not to say that I'm against any of the pre-Christian traditions. Pre-Christian traditions I find fascinating. But I see Christianity as a continuation of European traditions. The pre-Christian ones, which are just the older ones. It's like going to primary school and going to secondary school. It's the same person that went to primary school and then went to secondary school. Not a different person. And we were the same people when we were pagans as we are when we were Christians. And the Christian faith is full of what it means to be white, basically. We can also see the importance of the church to Geoffrey of Monmouth, and also that the Holy Land wasn't somewhere separate to Britain. It wasn't somewhere cut off from Britain as if it was foreign people, because these records that we have of these British kings, alongside them is mention of what's happening in Judea at the time, like 1115 to 1075 BC. Brutus, the first king of Britain, reigns 23 years. Locrinus reigns 10 years. And this was at a time when Eli was the judge in Israel. After that, we get Gwendolyn and Madden, and that was at the time that Samuel was a judge in Israel. Mimpricius, 1050 to 1011. King Saul was reigning in Judea at that time. At the time of King David, we've got Ebracus, King Solomon, Brutus Greenshield. So we've got all these important events that were happening in Judea that are linked up with what was happening in Britain at the time. And you find the same thing in The Brute, The Chronicle of England. It links together the events happening in the Holy Land that were also happening in Britain. And we also have mention of Partaloon, or Partalus, I believe he's called. He's given a different name in Geoffrey of Monmouth's The History of the Kings of Britain. And that was a Phoenician king. And this is who L.A. Waddle wrote about in his book, The Phoenician Origin of the Anglo-Saxons and the Welsh and the Britons and everyone else in Britain. So, and he traced this to a stone. There's a stone in Scotland which has got this Partaloon's name on it, this king from Phoenicia. Because we had trade with Phoenicia and the Middle East, because Britain was the place where you got your tin from, and tin was so important for everything, really, for making various different alloys. And these traders would have to come to Britain to pick it up, and the Phoenicians, they kept hidden where it was that they were actually getting their tin from, and they would scupper their ships if anyone was following them. And we also have other histories that talk about Britain being a place where the tin mines, where the prisoners were put, or the outcasts were kept in Britain, and they would mine these tin mines. So we have records in Greek records, Roman records, pagan records, all talking about Britain being the Isles of Tin and being a civilized place, an important place. which they don't, which the establishment would rather you didn't think about today. They just want you to think that we were barbarians, or we evolved from being cavemen living here in the ice instead of making our way over here from the summerland. I mean, this is the earliest records that we have. They all say that we came over from Asia Minor, from the summerland. We also have quite a few mentions of the King of Africa. And the King of Africa, one time he goes to Mercia, and then he eventually goes over to Ireland. And the King of Africa was either the Vandals, well, after the Vandals took over Carthage, or it would have been one of these white kings of Africa. It certainly wasn't Negroes. It was definitely a white man. And you can also see that even though these were white nations that were invading Britain or asking to live there, the British people wouldn't give them their wives. And don't forget earlier on, this shows you how friendly the original Britons were. Ships would arrive full of white people, and they would ask whether they could have some land and a place to colonize, and the king would say, yes, you can. You can head up to the north. You can have your territory up there in Albany. And this happens a couple of times. These ships arrive, they pledge allegiance to the British king, and they get given land to settle. And it's only later on, 1,000 years later, that you get these invasions and these fights and these wars. So you can imagine at the time the world itself was just there to be colonized. The Fertile Crescent, obviously the first place where civilization took off, and then the white nations they were just white tribes and clans spread out from there to colonize the earth. Obviously Britain was in the north, so it was colonized rather later than the warm regions. But once the warm regions became overpopulated or ravaged by war or too much miscegenation, then the whites would travel on to somewhere else. And we still have a remnant of that in the founding myths of the Anglo-Saxons that say that it was their tradition that when too many people were in the country, a large group of them would move off to find somewhere else to live and to colonize somewhere else. And there's lots of other things that I could mention about the book. Maybe I should have taken some notes saying this is just off the cuff. Things that thoughts that I've had while going through it. And I do very much enjoy the speeches. I think the speeches, the rousing speeches that they give, it gives you an understanding of the sort of insults that they would throw at people. To be effeminate, to be womanlike, that was an insult that would be used at the time. For a man to be effeminate was always the most insulting thing that anyone could ever say. And yet today, we seem to think it's desirable for a man to be effeminate. These rousing speeches about love of your fatherland and love of your ancestors and being prepared to lay down your lives in battle, a glorious death. You know, it wasn't just the Vikings and the Saxons that said this. This was the Britons. This was all white people. And some of the most rousing speeches that are recorded in the book come from once the people have become Christian, once they have become Christianized, as it were. As I say, because it's still the same people. Whether we were pagans or Christians, we were still white people. It's not as if we suddenly stopped being white once we became Christian, or as if it was some foreign people that were building the churches. It was white people that were doing that. It was us that were doing that. It was our land, our temples. We could do with them whatever we pleased. We could do whatever we pleased with them. I had a conversation recently at the Purity Spiral saying about how the Christians destroyed the ancient pagan temples. But they didn't destroy the ancient pagan temples. They were told to reconsecrate them and explicitly don't destroy them. But even if they had destroyed them, it would have been our people destroying them. It would have been our ancestors destroying them. It wasn't Romans that invaded and destroyed the temples and built churches. It was our own British people that did that. But they didn't do that. They kept them going. They built, in some of them, they built churches within the stone circle. In some of them, the church is gone, but the stone circle is still there. It was preserved by the church. And I live in a very rural area in Britain, and you can see these old stones that were obviously a part of ritual complexes years ago, and yet now they're just gateposts. The farmers have knocked them down, used them as gateposts, used them as troughs, put them in a hedge, really not very well looked after them. And then you find other ones that have been discovered, that a farmer has discovered. This was once obviously an important stone. It's got markings on it. And they've taken it from where it was being used as a gatepost, and they'll put it in the church, and they'll give it pride of place in the church so that it's saved for posterity. So it's actually the church that saves these things, because the locals would smash them up and use them for building material. I mean, look at Avebury in Somerset. A lot of that's been smashed up, and the houses there are built from these stones. And it's absolutely tragic, but it wasn't the church doing that. It was the local people doing that. The official instruction from the Church of Rome was to reconsecrate these places, not to damage them in any way. And if you think about it, the Vatican itself is built on an old pagan temple. I believe Chartres Cathedral is. A lot of these important cathedrals are built on these ancient sacred places. And the original churches in Britain were built in sacred places as well. They weren't built in the middle of a settlement. They were built in a sacred spot, and then the settlement grew around it. So these places were still held with reverence and awe by our people. All that stopped there was the worship of the nature spirits. And if you read the ancient Welsh records, they would say that they weren't worshipping these nature spirits anyway. They only ever worshipped one god, but in many different ways. And they could see that their god expressed himself in a myriad of different ways. It's rather similar to Hinduism. There's one god, but there's various different aspects to him. I'm wandering a little bit off the topic now, and we've also got to the end of the time allotted for this podcast. So I hope you've enjoyed listening to this. I hope this has given you some more things to think about, and I hope you enjoyed the series of the history of the kings of Britain. I'm not quite sure what we will be doing next, and I'm hoping that we may be able to bring the Daily Traditionalist back next week. So thank you very much for listening, and hail victory!